Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
True. And there's a lot that goes into that. The ensuing result should be all about pleasure. We'll talk a little bit about what it takes to get that pleasure harnessed. So 2015, short vintage.
Wow. This one here, 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, which at this point is all, other than, of course, the Chardonnay, is all we produce on the estate. Although in, actually, 2015, we did, for the first time in our history, plant something other than Cabernet and Chardonnay. We planted a little bit of Cabernet Franc and a little bit of Petit Verdot. Just a couple acres on the estate that we actually got our first chance to play with last year with the 2018 vintage, and what will come from that in the future, we're still playing around with some ideas, but what we have in our glass here is 100% Cab.
This nose is ridiculously concentrated. I think it'd be easier to name flavors I'm not smelling. It's a long darn list.
Again, I mean, it goes, aromatics are so important to anything, food, wine. You know, you're going to see a glass of wine first and you're going to smell it before you taste it. And whether that comes from my culinary background, whether it comes from the wonderful winemakers that I have worked with, whether it was, you know, Bob Levy at Harlan Estate, whether it was Martha McClellan, who was clearly an initial mentor, as she and Bob were making the Levy McClellan brand at Harlan at the time, and she pointed at me as someone that she wanted to help oversee that and take care of cellar operations of the wine, and our founding winemaker here at Vineyard 78, Luke Morlay. And then a fast forward to 2014 when I got the opportunity to sort of close the loop and circle back with Martha as my original mentor and sort of person that fueled the fire for me on the production side of things. So, you know, all of those winemakers that I just spoke of, if you think of their wines, aromatics is at the forefront of those wines and the style of those wines that Bob, Luke, and Martha all have created. And so it's no coincidence that the style of wine that we hope to craft here with both of these brands at Vineyard 78 and Correlation Wine Company is about aromatics. So for us as winemakers, it comes down to the process. You know, how do we not only enhance, but how do we maintain and not lose those aromatics? And so, you know, that could be a whole other conversation, you know, underneath the skirt of winemaking and how we do it. But, you know, I could tell you that we try to say, if this is sort of a Luke would coin the phrase, we are non-interventionist, laissez-faire winemaking, which sounds lazy in its sort of general principle, but in the fact is actually the exact opposite. You know, we farm our vineyard sustainably. We just got our Napa Green certification last year. And so for us, you know, it's about taking care of the source of where your fruit comes from. It's about the care and attention to detail that fruit is given during the process of growing. It's not sort of looking at an entire block and saying you need to rush and get this entire block in one fell swoop. It's about going vine by vine. And as much as that might, you know, drive our vineyard crew crazy, we believe and appreciate that that's what's going to give us the best result. And, you know, sort of picking these mini fires, if you will, along the way of what's absolutely ready and allowing what needs a little bit more time the chance to go. And, you know, the 15, one of the things is, you know, production-wise that we did is, this wine is also, so we, you know, we have our stainless steel fermentations that we do on the cab, but we also do, almost with the estate, we almost do 50% of our fermentations are done in barrel. So, you know, that's taking a new French oak barrel and taking the head off of it, putting whole berries in it, putting the head back on it, putting it on rollers that we have, rolling the barrels and managing the fermentations for about 6 weeks. Until the point that we go in reverse and drain the wine, open up the barrel, take the fruit out, put the barrel back together, and put that resulting wine back into that barrel. It takes about 4 fermenting new barrels to yield 1 finished barrel. But aromatically and texturally, you're getting every version of tannin together from the very beginning. You know, you've got that grape tannin, that skin tannin, that seed tannin, and then that oak tannin, all bonding together from the very first moment of its life. And that sort of the inert environment of that barrel fermentation helps preserve those aromatics. The process helps create that texture. So it's really how do we, again, it goes back to how do we, each step of the process, let the wine dictate what it needs.
Wow, talk about value added. This didn't sound labor intensive or anything. So I'm glad this is being recorded because I missed the first half of what you just shared because I was too distracted by the finish in your wine. I've stopped counting at maybe 40, 50 seconds. No, seriously, and you just answered the question that was percolating in my mind as to that finish. How is it possible? The process you just described clearly contributes.
Absolutely.
Very heavily to that. Very thoughtful, very deliberate. I'm sure those processes were guided and proposed by your winemaking team, but yep. For you to sign up for that, I mean, that's a whole lot.
It is, and I was fine when Martha joined us in 2014, and I had experienced this process a little bit, you know, when I was at Harlan and Bond, and I knew the labor that it went into that, and probably at that time I didn't fully understand the economics of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up here, and you know, when I'm the one that signs the checks and has to balance the checkbook, if you will. And Martha and I started talking about this process and we wanted to do it and why we wanted to do it and philosophically what was it going to do to our wines. I was skeptical. I was scared. I was like, oh my goodness, you want to wait? What? You want to take four brand new barrels and we're going to use those four barrels for 2 months. And at the end of it, we're only going to be using one of those barrels and we have three barrels you haven't used. I'm like, well, that sounds like it doesn't necessarily make sense, and that's not really going to help help the business. But all it took was really one time doing it up here and seeing what it did to the wines and what it brought to the complexity and the depth made complete sense to us. And so we figured out how to make it work. And I think that's where, you know, you think like the consumer, like, oh my goodness, so, you know, Napa Cab costs so much. Of course, unfortunately, I can test. It doesn't cost so much so that we can make a bigger profit. It costs so much so that we can do anything and everything needed to make the best possible wine we can for you.
This is a whole other level. I mean, I can't imagine the conversations you have with your accountant because you just described $5,000 worth of barrels that goes to produce one.
Mm-hmm.
A little blown away. But obviously this decision is motivated by you put your money where your mouth is, quite literally. And in addition to your own perspective on this, which is, you know, wholly valuable, you nurture this from moment one, this wine. What have the consumers been saying? We know the press has been very kind, they better be, because, you know, this is extraordinary. What type of feedback do you hear from your guests when they taste your wine?
I think the consistent message, there's the appreciation of, again, the aromatic jump that comes of wines when they're bottled, when the wine's opened, whether it's decanted, the texture and the acidity. I mean, again, as I said earlier, this goes back to really creating wines that are food-centric, that, you know, to me, I've had a lot of people say, and I appreciate the fact that people say that it's more of a intellectual style of wine because, you know, to me, a great wine is like a great book. You know, it's about, you know, you've read that first chapter, you know, there's another chapter to come, but it hasn't quite presented itself yet. And it's like smelling a great wine. It's like you get that initial layer, but you can see that there's something sitting on the edge on the back of that next page. And you can't wait to get there, and all of a sudden that next page is turned and you're introduced to a completely new layer. And it's that layer upon layer upon layer in a great bottle of wine, to me, that keeps me interested. And I think that's where, you know, we've had people say that that's one of the things they love about our wine, is that, you know, does continue to evolve in the glass, that there's, it's not just there this linear one shot, you know, expression. And, you know, certainly it helps to be where we are, up on the hill and in the mountains, and, you know, the climate that helps us create those layers. But
so it's really not about the language of being able to describe and articulate, but it's about the actual quality and the emotion and the perceptions and correlations that it evokes in your own mind. So when people taste your wine, there's a visible, visceral reaction, and you observe that. And that's so huge because, you know, in the industry, we get into the weeds, we have our own lingo, we talk to each other.
Sure.
And none of that really matters as much as watching somebody's face when they're trying something and they can't quite put their finger on it, but they know it's so darn special.
Yeah.
And you've created so much in that sense, so much value, and yet your wines are not nearly as pricey. I'll just be direct as... you know, let's pick on Harlan. I mean, yes, it's a epic, you know, probably in a lot of people's minds, a reference point for Bordeaux iteration in
sure.
California.
I mean, it's
language.
A Napa Valley first growth.
Yeah,
there's,
exactly.
There's no question about that.
And what you're describing practices-wise, I should say, is similar. Mm-hmm. I'm not comparing the two, but again, I'm not critiquing the price point. I'm saying that you're delivering at that level, aren't you?
Yeah, and price is hard. I mean, I think because consumers, and I mean, like, listen, I'm a consumer too. I wouldn't be in this industry if I didn't love wine. And you know, when I get, you know, it comes to offering season, and my email inbox hits, and I get offered from this winery and that winery, and
yeah.
It's hard, right? Because you look at, okay, this is, you know, this is what I have. This is what I can spend on this bottle of wine. But I, thankfully, from being on this side of it, I know that, you know, there's a lot of truth to be told on those price points.
Yep.
And you know, in many, you know, many cases, and it's, you know, certainly the brands that I trust and appreciate, I know that those price points aren't sort of falsified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're there so that they get to do, you know, they charge those price points so that they hopefully get to do this again next year.
Yep.
You know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, what is, to me, what is success? You know, this business, you know, it's, you know, is it critical acclaim? No. Is it nice? Absolutely critical acclaim. It makes everybody smile, right? I mean, when you're told that you did a good job for something, it goes back to the grassroots of getting a star on your homework in grade school. Feels good, it sort of helps support the efforts that you're putting into it. But to me, you know, this is a lifestyle, what I'm involved in. This is something that I'm living, and you think of a traditional job and you're working towards retirement. I don't know what the heck retirement looks like in this industry. Maybe it means I'm driving a tractor and I'm drinking wine and watching my kids go through the blood, sweat, and tears on a daily basis. But the grassroots of what success means to me in this is I get to do this again next year.
And I know you mean it. I know wholeheartedly you're so invested, and the fact that you're able to maintain the cost control actually kind of blows my mind, given what you just described and given the labor costs, the increasing cost of living. I mean, there's a ton of contributing economic factors to what winds up in that price point.
Sure.
And the moment you start investigating, you wind up thinking this is that you're losing money on it, that
sure.
It's too cheap. I mean, that's honestly what comes up for me.
Absolutely.
But the fact that you would never compromise your standards is so important and so reassuring. And Napa, you know, as a whole, just taking a helicopter view, is growing. So even though it's not technically competition because everybody does different things, there's still that level of awareness.
Oh, for sure.
So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the future. You now observed the Valley for a couple of decades and clearly have been an integral part of it. What's your observations about, you know, where it is today and where is it going? Where is it trending?
You know, here we are looking at a crystal ball.
Yeah.
Where is it going to be? I mean, I think the valley is in a really great place. You're starting to see, some of those initial pioneers, mm-hmm. The Bill Harlins, the Naoko Dalival, the Ann Colgans, Spotswood, who's truly one of my mentor brands and that I look at as a family-run estate. But you look at these iconic brands mm-hmm. of sort of even during the dot-com phase and when Napa Valley really hit stride and became, this destination place with incredible wines, you're starting to see sort of a generational shift. And you see that next generation getting involved. You see, people coming into the great Napa Valley trying to, have their slice of the pie, and there's a lot of investment coming into the valley. There's a lot of people with passion coming in, wanting to create something really, really great, and try their version of it. So, that old adage, rising tide raises all ships, is so true. Where is it and where is it going? Well, we've talked about it throughout the day here, is that, the quality of wine in Napa Valley is getting better by the day. The number of wines and quality brands that are getting surfacing is growing by the day. Is that going to hit a saturation point? I imagine for sure it will. Mm-hmm. And will there be a natural weeding out process? Like anything, I'm sure there will. But we as consumers sort of win by that process, because mm-hmm. we're all pushing each other to be better. And where is it going? I mean, I think what's been interesting is there's been a lot of conversation, just from a business standpoint, from various articles, from various industry insights, as to, okay, you had the baby boomers who were the wine collectors, and now their cellars are getting filled, and they're counting the number of bottles and saying, well, I can't quite possibly drink all this wine before my time. So then we jump, okay, what's the next consumer? Is it, and everyone talks about the millennials, mm-hmm. and what is the buying pattern of the millennial? Have they inherited the same passion of wine as their parents? And I think we're still trying to learn that. There's more things available, whether it's great craft beer, whether it's great, it's cocktails, mixology, whether it's the rise of legal cannabis in the world. There's many options for your vices out there these days. But I sort of circle back to that and say, why are we skipping Generation X? Why are we skipping my generation? I'm just coming into this, maybe I'm finally getting established in my career, and my kids are getting older, and I'm hopefully, successful for my family. And, so maybe I'm finally at a stage in my life that I can start saying yes to a couple more of these offering letters, and I can start building my own collection. I mean, I don't remember exactly how old my father was when he built his, but he wasn't my age. So, I think we're getting too impatient about wondering why millennials aren't jumping on board buying all these wines right now. Well, they're not ready to yet. They're in their 20s and early 30s. They shouldn't. They're up. They're supposed to have fun. They're supposed to be going out. They're establishing their own careers. So they don't have the disposable income for a lot of these wines. I want someone to talk about, why are we skipping a generation? Why are we skipping the generation that is the next generation?
I'm so glad you brought it up. I think I've lost my voice a couple of times talking about this very issue.
Yeah.
Because there seems to be this insane chase of how to get millennials to pay attention to fine wine. And the thing of it is, it's not like they don't. We treat them like aliens.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're just like us.
Yeah.
We used to be that. We just consume, they consume information differently. They do it via handheld device as mm-hmm. opposed to a traditional media or whatever. It's still the same type of messaging. It's still the same storytelling.
Yep.
So probably we should be asking ourselves a question, how do we tell our story better?
Mm-hmm.
Your story is phenomenal, and you're clearly very well versed in telling that. But you don't stop. Every
day. You can't
day.
Stop.
you have to keep talking about it. And it's
well,
authentic.
That's where social media gets into play, which has become, and I think it's almost funny. Like, you look at advertising almost in its nature. You look at every other industry, even in the every other industry in the luxury good market, look at handbags, look at wallets, purses, pens, the other fine spirits. You know, is Louis Vuitton, are they shunned upon for advertising in the Robb Report? No, they're not. People want to see that sexy advertisement of, you know, that woman holding that this season's new bag that now everybody wants. But the same isn't true for wine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's frustrating because, you know, could I go take a sexy photograph of my bottle of wine and put it in a magazine, you know, in the same parameters that, you know, these other luxury goods are doing? Yeah, for certain I could, but, then the consumers are saying, well, no, you just bought your way into that magazine so you could get a good score. And that part's almost hard too, because you think of, you know, there's no other luxury good market that is held to the same, I guess, parameters, if you will, when it comes to critical acclaim. You know, it's like, look at, you know, and the adage I always use is, you know, like the Michelin guide.
Yeah.
You know, the Michelin guide, when they go to give the French Laundry 3 stars, you know, that's not just one visit. You know, it's, you know, the Michelin inspectors, they're coming, you know, sometimes, in many cases, unknown. They're coming a couple times, they're dining, they're not only tasting the food, they're looking at the service, they're looking at the napkins, is the bathroom clean, and it's the whole picture that ultimately goes to creating what is that 3-star rating. Go to wine criticism. You know, wine criticism, especially for new wines, is often, it's a snapshot of a wine that's a barrel sample that is in its infant stage, and in some cases, in most cases, probably a wine that isn't even completely finished. And it's a wine that's tasted on, and if you're lucky to taste face-to-face with that wine critic and tell your story along with it, or do you have to submit it blindly and you get 15 seconds of attention to taste that wine that is this thing that is a living, breathing animal that's one snapshot. And so their mark is put on that wine, and it lives with the life of that wine. You know, it's like saying the Michelin guy to walk into the walk-in cooler at the French Laundry, you know, with their hands over their eyes so they're not swayed by anything else they see along the way, and taking a carrot out of the bin and saying, okay, based on this carrot, French Laundry gets 3 Michelin stars. So there's so many things. Like, why, you know, Louis Vuitton, oh yeah, the cow this year, you know, the leather wasn't so good. You know, the weather, the rained too much, and the cow ate too much grass, so the leather isn't quite the quality that we'd hope. So, you know, this bag gets a 92. Or this year, oh man, the conditions are great, the cow ate great feed this year, it was so happy, you know, its friends were nice to them, and the leather that came from that was just exceptional. This bag, 100 points.
You're describing a level of scrutiny in the restaurant business that, which is why so many restaurants go out of business, because even the Michelin level, it's just a tough one.
Yeah.
And that's a well-known fact, but when it comes to wine, people are so swayed by the romance of it, they completely forget everything else. And the thing is, wine is a product of patience.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a minimum, 4 years for the vineyard to even come to any sort of, you know, production?
Oh, yeah.
And then everything else that we talked about, what it really goes into, you know, what needs to happen in order for people to produce a bottle of wine, not something ethereal that's going to make you, you know, remember dreams of lost childhood, but just a bottle of wine. And yet, you know, we are not necessarily finding those relational things as often as we could. I mean, the bag is all about FOMO.
Sure,
right?
Sure, absolutely.
But with wine, it's like, well, there's many bottles. But the truth is, there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a marketing speak when we say this bottle of wine is rare.
Well, we make, so Vineyard 7 and 8, between the Cabernet and Chardonnay, we make less than 1,000 cases. So 1,000 cases, 1,200 bottles.
And each vintage obviously is unique.
Yeah.
And you will never have two of the same, even if you wanted to. I mean, there's a consistency.
We're not making Coca-Cola here.
Exactly. In terms of you know, cellar cleanliness and certain practices of that nature, the practicalities. The rest of it is pure art.
Sure.
It's whatever nature delivers. And it's up to you to interpret it in any given year. So you are getting a piece of art, and that's not high pathos.
Sure.
But, you know, in terms of justifying the cost and the effort, that makes the most sense to me, is that you're buying something unique.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, somebody's buying your point of view.
True.
So you have to align with that.
Yeah.
But you also don't necessarily need or want everybody to buy into. That'd be kind of interesting. So it has to be a group of people that, again, align palatally, intellectually with you.
My wine's not for everybody, and I know that, and that doesn't bother me. It can't. On many occasions, you know, you pour your glass of wine for somebody and they say, well, it's nice, but it's just not my style. That's okay. I understand that. I have a style of wine I like too. So you can't appease everybody, but you find those people that, as you said, that align with what you're doing. And that's who you share that relationship with.
So since you have such a chefy background, you brought up food and wine several times, I have to ask. I mean, I'm sure you go out to eat quite a bit in your travels and in general.
Sure. Not as much as I used to. Three kids and two wine brands make that more challenging.
So you cook at home, right?
Probably not as much as my wife would like, but I do at times, yes. I always bring home wine.
Good. So that's halfway there. There's so many conversations, again, about food and wine pairing. I feel like it's become an obsession.
Sure.
What is your take on it?
I hold a fairly simplistic view of this, and it goes back to almost our philosophy in hospitality that everybody's tastes are different. On a grassroots level, am I a steak and Cabernet guy? For sure. You know, if I have my choice, I'm going to have a really beautifully grilled filet or New York strip, you know, not a whole lot of just olive oil, salt and pepper and a great bottle of Cab, and I'm a happy guy. But does that mean I'm not going to drink Cab with a great piece of fish? Oh my gosh, you know, is that Cab going to overpower the fish? No, I'm going to enjoy each of them separately for what they are. So I feel that there can and should be fluctuation in food and wine pairings based on what you like. You know, it is the end of the day. It's what do you like? What makes you happy? If having a glass of champagne with a fish tacos makes you excited, cool. Then that's the best food and wine pairing for you for that moment. Is that a traditional food and wine pairing? No. But does that mean it's wrong? No.
Context.
Yeah.
So if somebody doesn't have access to, you know, the largesse of California, specifically Napa Valley, and just really has some interest but is quite intimidated by the whole notion of fine wine, and they don't know where to start, what would be your advice?
Come to Vineyard 7-8 and we'll teach you. No.
Actually, it's not a bad place to learn.
It's not a bad place to learn. No, I mean, you hear everyone say the best way to learn about wine is to taste wine, and the reality is that's true. You know, do you have to start with the Harlan Estates of the world or the Vineyard 7 and 8? No, of course not. When I started in college, when I was in school up in the Finger Lakes region, which is certainly another beautiful wine region of this country. Yep. I was drinking Fox Run Pinot Noir and Dr. Lucen Riesling, and I didn't know what I was drinking. I enjoyed it, and it sort of maybe lit that fire. You know, I think when I talk to everybody that, you know, friends of mine in this industry or wine consumers, most everybody has a wine that sort of was their aha wine. Mm-hmm. What was the wine that sort of teased them enough to say, there's something here. Mm-hmm. I want to dig deeper. Mm-hmm. I want to explore further. So you're going to find it. I mean, if you find that wine's your thing, and, you know, my favorite is when you hear someone say, oh, I don't like Pinot. Okay. It's fine. There's other varietals, or maybe you haven't had the right Pinot. Hmm. And that's the thing. I mean, you think of the number of varietals, the number of regions, the number of producers. I mean, it's endless. So there's something out there for you. If wine's your thing, and that's fine. If it's not, it's not for everybody. But I think it's just, you know, it's, with anything in life, it's experimentation. It's trying. It's seeing what works. It's tasting different foods. Well, I don't like that food. I like that food. I don't like that varietal. I like this one. So I think the simple answer to that question is just experimenting, trying, not being afraid to try. If you don't like it, so what? It's okay. You're not supposed to like everything, but you'll find something that you like. You'll find that aha, you know, eventually if you like it enough, if you stick with it enough, you're going to get that wine and that you're going to find that aha wine that says, yep, there's something here. And that aha wine doesn't have to be something, you know, cellar, you know, doesn't have to be this gem of your cellar that you tasted at a friend's house. It could be something very simple that says, wow, yeah, I really like that. That spoke to me. Now I want to dig deeper.
So the message here is fight complacency. And you're a very good example. I would dare say poster child, because you had other options early on in life and you decided to discover enough about you. You had enough inherent self-awareness to say, this fits me and this doesn't.
Sure.
And you pursued it. And that's a big deal. That's why your quality of life is what it is. So even though you happen to make wine and, you know, obviously hugely engaged in this world, I think there's a bigger picture here. I think your self-awareness was a pathway to something that really fulfills you every day, even on a bad day, as stressful as things get. You wouldn't do anything else, would you?
If you're not passionate about what you're doing, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, if you get out of the bit. I mean, we're on this journey. This version of this journey that we're on, you get once, however long it is, and if you can't be happy with it, if you can't be passionate about it, and in that path, you should be on a different path. And again, it goes back to my parents, of them saying, you know, please, I don't care what you do. I mean, I want you to do something. I want you to be successful in life, but I want you to be successful doing something that you love, because ultimately you're going to be more successful when you're passionate about it than not.
It's a beautiful sentiment to end on. I want to thank you very much, Wes, for hosting me and sharing your story with such candor.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.